Hi, thanks for coming today. Today we have Lee Talbot here to talk about Blinky Palermo's use of textiles, and he is the Associate Curator of the Eastern Hemisphere's collection at the Textile Museum here in Washington. And recent exhibitions that he's done there include Art by the Yard, Women Design Mid-Century Britain, and Second Lives, the Age-Old Art of Recycling Textiles. And right now at the Textile Museum, his exhibition Green, the Color and the Cause just opened last weekend. And he's also on the editorial board of the Textile Journal of Cloth and Culture, and has been a juror for the American Tapestry Alliance and the World Textile Art Biennial. And so I'll give it over to him now. Thanks.
All right, so thank you all for coming this afternoon and joining me to look at a selection of artworks by the seminal German artist Blinky Palermo. Now, I'm not an expert on Palermo, and indeed, I'm not an expert on 20th century German art. But as Jenny mentioned in her introduction, I am a specialist in textiles, and as we'll see, textiles are an integral component of some of Palermo's best-known work. Palermo is known as an artist's artist. He's highly regarded by his peers, by younger generations of artists. And this is the first retrospective of his work in North America. So I'm very excited to have the opportunity to spend some time with this work and think about it in relation to some ideas that I've been exploring more closely in my research, namely textiles as art, mid-20th century textiles as expressions of society and culture at the time, and also color in textiles and how and why people created these colors. Joseph Beuys, who was Palermo's teacher, very famously described Palermo as being an artist with great porosity. And by that, he meant that he had a very open approach and interest in open dialogue and exchange. And so with that in mind, I would like to think that Palermo would welcome porosity in the interpretation of his work as well. And so today, I'll be telling you about his work from the perspective of a textile historian, but I hope that it might encourage you to look at his work and appreciate his work in new ways. Are many of you familiar with Palermo, with his biography? I know some are shaking their heads that they're not. This tour won't really be a traditional history of Palermo, critique of him. I'll just say a couple of things about him. He was born in 1943 in Leipzig. Growing up, he was adopted. He was named Peter Heisterkamp. But he went, when he was at the Dusseldorf Kunstakademie, which at that time was just really a cutting-edge art academy. And as I mentioned, his teacher, Joseph Beuys, Beuys reportedly said something to him like, if you want to change your manner, you have to change yourself. And he adopted a pseudonym. He adopted the name Blinky Palermo, who is an actual person. He was a mafioso, Italian-American boxing manager. And it's significant that he took an American name because he was very influenced by American culture, beat literature, and such. So I'm starting in this room because Palermo primarily thought of himself as a painter. And in this room, the way I interpret it is he's looking at painting, he's distilling it down into its most essential elements, and he's asking, what is painting, and indeed, what is art? He was pursuing abstract painting at a time when abstract painting was starting to lose steam, people were starting to question its relevance. So in Western post-Renaissance art, painting and sculpture generally are privileged as the highest of the arts. And a painting generally is defined as it usually has a wooden frame, a stretcher of some kind. It has a textile stretched over it, and then the artist uses a brush to apply a pattern. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. And why don't you get a little bit closer so that you can see it? So this is more like a conventional painting than what we will be seeing in other rooms in the exhibition. But if you look at it carefully, you see there's a distortion at the bottom. He actually used for the wooden frame of this a chalkboard. And then he stretched the linen fabric over that. And my take on this is just that he's showing us each part that goes into making the painting. There is a base for the painting, a wooden base. Here it's screaming out its presence by actually jutting out past the picture frame with the ledge on the bottom. And then, of course, there is a textile. In this case, it's actually a very fine linen. Artists around the world prefer textiles as a surface for their painting. Now, usually they're completely covered in paint and you forget about the textile element there. But here he's actually left part of the linen blank. He hasn't gessoed it. It's just a raw textile. You can see the warp and the weft there. And then he's used oil paints to apply this black pattern. And again, he's making it very apparent. You can see the hand of the artist. You can see the drag of the brush. So each part of the painting is made very distinct. He's making visible all the means of making a painting. And in this work, he's taking all those elements and he's kind of deconstructing them. We see these long wooden pieces, which can be used, say, for a frame, for instance. These have been wrapped in a textile and then painted. So, and then in the middle, there is a little hint of maybe what a traditional painting surface might be like. So again, he's taking all the elements, the traditional elements that are used in a painting, but he's rearranging them in this way. A little further down the wall, you'll see when you turn the corner there, a similar idea, but he's taken a found object. It's the one that has a corner, this is an architectural piece, possibly a window frame. And in any case, a found object that, again, he has wrapped it in a textile. He's wrapped it in canvas and then painted it in these sharply contrasting colors. Now, all the pieces that I've been talking about so far are untitled. It's unusual for him to give a title to a work. But one that is titled is this piece, which is called the English name for it, Landscape. And again, he is using found wood. He's using found objects that he has wrapped in textiles. And then he has painted. And he's arranged them in this spatial relationship that suggests a landscape. We have green below and blue on top. But if you look carefully in the lower portion, you can see a little bit of the original fabric showing through. He's covered this wood with a blue fabric and then painted over it with green. But a little bit of the blue is showing through. And again, it is creating these sort of spatial relationships that suggest a landscape. But he's doing it with these long horizontals, this horizontal line. And keep that in mind, because that's a point that we will be returning to when we get to the Stoffbilder. But again, he's using the same formula, the essential elements that traditionally go into a painting, a wooden base, a textile, and then over that is applied paint. So let's just go around the corner. We'll look at one more piece in these galleries before going to look at the Stoffbilder. I do want to say that one thing I didn't emphasize before, that he had a very short career. He was active 12 or 13 years or so. the works that we're looking at were all created in a space of less than a decade. And he was working simultaneously in many different modes. So I don't want to imply that we're starting at a beginning point and then going through time to an end point. A lot of these are ideas that he was working through simultaneously. And he left several distinct groups of work, the works that are more three-dimensional, that are on the wall without a background, he called objects, and then the works that are made primarily with cloth, he called a stoff builder or cloth paintings. And what we're looking at here is kind of a combination of these two. This is called, the English translation in this exhibition is soft speaker. I won't attempt the German pronunciation, but it implies whispering, speaking softly. And on top, you see a found fabric that has been pinned to the wall. And then below it is the same fabric that has been stretched over a frame, more like a traditional painting. And at least my interpretation of this is the reason why, to me, it makes sense to call this soft speaker, because I think these are in a dialogue with each other. They're speaking to each other. Now, for some people at the time and even today, it's a little bit shocking to take just a plain piece of cloth and put it on the wall, pin it on the wall, and call it art. But of course, I'm a textile historian. To me, that makes perfect sense. Textiles surround us in our daily lives. They can bring a lot of beauty into interiors. And I think this is what he's getting at with here. A plain piece of found cloth, a more traditional piece of cloth that has been put over a frame or over a stretcher. We can derive visual pleasure, sensual gratification from both of these. It doesn't have to be put in a traditional painting format. So now, if you'll follow me through, that we'll go through the next gallery and then into the following gallery, which are the where you'll find the cloth paintings. All right, so in 1966... Palermo embarked on his largest and best-known body of work, which are called the Stoff Builder or Cloth Paintings. For these, the source material comes directly from department stores. This is commercial cloth sold by the Bolt, and he has just taken these, sewn them together, and put them on to a stretcher. At the time, a good friend of his was the artist Gerhard Richter, and they would both go on shopping expeditions together. Palermo was very interested in looking at fabrics. Richter was fascinated with the color charts that he found in paint stores and carpentry stores there. But what they're both looking at is finding anonymous, ready-made source material, and then using that in their art. So how exactly were they made? Well, he would buy these cloths, take them to his studio. He would arrange them on the floor and get exactly the right color combinations that he liked, the right proportions between the various colors. Then he would pin them and then have them sewn and stretch and put onto a stretcher. Now, at the beginning, he did sew them himself, but he was not very good with a sewing machine. So he called upon his first wife, Ingrid, to do the sewing. And then later, Gerhard Richter's wife, Emma, also would do the sewing as well. So the colors are determined by what he found available mostly in Dusseldorf department stores. The maximum proportions are also determined by the bolts of cloth that he would find. It's the DIN, the Deutsche Industry Norm, dictated exactly the size that these bolts of cloth would be. So they seem very simple in many ways, and in fact, one of his friends, the artist Sigmar Polka, said, this is a quote by him, it says, "While others were toiling away at I don't know what, he sewed two pieces of fabric together and had the day off." But as simple as they might seem, they're addressing many concerns that Palermo had at the time, namely the German economic miracle, the role of modernist painting at the time, and also the modern art market in Germany. Boys, Joseph Beuys, his teacher, who was a very influential artist and still is today, I'll read a quote from him. He says that Palermo he's interested in the way people live, the way they live in space. Human habitation, that was very important to him. The way they inhabit, the way they live, what chairs they sat in, what they have around them. So I think that these cloth pictures really capture that. They capture, to me, so very much the time in which he was living, and they directly mirror a consumer culture at the time. So even though he was going to department stores and finding these colors ready-made, these colors were actually carefully thought out by the manufacturers of textiles. The time has a lot to do with the German economic miracle after the war. Of course, like all of Europe, Germany had been destroyed. They were very dark years during the war, in the rebuilding years. But we're talking now in the mid-1960s. They're starting to have a lot of there's money available, and it's often called, you know, the economic miracle. Textiles were a part of that. Textiles were a huge industry in Germany. Not for long. They would start to move in the early 70s. And these companies, of course, would want to create textiles that people wanted to buy. They used colors. They produced colors that were fashionable, that were sellable at that time. And at this time, the preference was for bright, bold colors. This mirrored the optimism at the time. And you see it not just in Germany, but indeed all over Western Europe. So these colors are mirroring the sort of buoyancy, the optimism that you see in German society at this time. But also, it's mirroring what we also see in advertising at the time. These these geometric shapes, these sharp delineations of color, are certainly what was popular in advertising in the 1960s as well. And it's also mirroring what we see in fashion at that time. The name that we most closely associate with these blocks of color is the French designer Courrèges, but there were many others as well. And I do have some visuals for you. If you want to pass these around, these are images of a photo shoot that was taken in front of Palermo's early Stoffbilder or cloth paintings. And you can see that these 60s fashions provide a perfect foil for these cloth paintings, these bright, sharply contrasting planes of color. Now, interestingly, what you see in the background there are some of his early cloth paintings that he actually destroyed. Some of the earlier ones were smaller in format than you see here. And also, many of the earlier ones were made of shiny materials, such as satins. And he didn't comment on this. We don't know why. I would speculate that with satins, there is a sheen, light catches this, And it downplays the sharp contrast between the two color planes. What he used almost exclusively to the end is a balanced plane weave cotton, which gives a very nice texture. There is no sheen on it, so it gives a very sharp demarcation between the two planes of color. And of course, these are very decorative. They looked good in homes at the time. And I'll read a quote from one critic. It said that he couldn't decide, let me find it here, whether he was a painter, an interior decorator, or a cold modernist. But indeed, I do think that he had interior decoration in mind. They look very good in homes. The way that they are hung very low, and the way that they're hung in this gallery is similar to the way that he would he hung them in galleries. The large size, they are usable. They're something that people could conceive using and decorating in their home. Some of the earliest ones were divided vertically like this. But over time, he went exclusively to these horizontal divisions. And there may be many reasons for that. Having this this vertical division, the left and right eyes kind of go in different directions. You get a greater harmony with these horizontal divisions. But I think that there's more than that as well. When we looked at the piece in the other room called Landscape, you saw that there was just two pieces of wood put together, and it creates this horizon line that creates the look of a landscape. And I think that he must have had this in mind as well. Certainly when we look at this one, for instance, with green on the bottom and blue on the top, it does give the impression of a landscape. And in fact, many of his classmates called him a landscape painter, somewhat jokingly. But also in the late 1960s, around the time that he was doing these, he also did a series of seascapes. And in those seascapes, you also see the only hint of the sea is just a thin horizontal line. So I think that this is something that he... that he certainly does have in mind. And of course, these colors were popular colors that were produced at the time, but all of them probably had some sort of implications at the time as well. I'm particularly drawn to this one, which is two shades of green. Today is Earth Day, so it is appropriate that we should be looking at that one. But one question that I have about it that I certainly wish that we could find out. Well, his teacher was Joseph Boys, as I've said a couple of times. Joseph Boys was a founding member of the Green Party. Right about this time, the Green Party wasn't founded yet when he was making these, but these ideas were being formulated, and Palermo was very much a part of Boys's milieu at the time. So you really wonder if there was any sort of connotations of what we think of as green with this green on green one. These were very, as I mentioned, these were popular. They sold well for many reasons. I said they fit well in interiors at the time. They were colors that were popular at the time. Landscape is the most popular type of painting, and these have this hint of landscape. And also in Germany at this time, American painting was popular as well. And he certainly is making these references to American painters. I think most significantly when we look at pieces like this, to Mark Rothko. And whereas Rothko had these sort of shimmering planes of color that had some sort of hint of depth, we're getting a much sharper division with these cloth paintings. But in ones like this, there is a little bit more ambiguity. Is it two colors or is it three? And so it gives this sort of Rothko-like effect. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that I think that Palermo, in the way that he brought together popularism and the market, looking at interior design at the time, he opened up new forms, new materials for new generation of artists. And also, in his use of textiles, I applaud him for that as well. Textiles they're ubiquitous in our daily lives. You know, they surround us from the time we're born till the time we die, as clothing, as upholstery, drapery. They're around us. And incorporating textiles into his work, as he's done here, he's showing that there don't have to be divisions between high art and everyday life. He's showing us that art is in the intention and in the creativity of the artist, and beauty is in the eye of the beholder, not exactly in the materials that he might be using. So, thank you very much for coming. So, do you have any questions?
Do you think there's also a reference here to German Romantic landscape painting, which has, you know, this history of German art in the 19th century? There's so much in painting and famous landscape painting.
I think that you may be right. As far as I know, he never commented, or we don't have recorded comments of Palermo about the Stoffbilder series and why he was doing this and much information about that. But I just think when you look at these and you look at some of his other works and some of his other works, that he is directly looking at landscape, even naming it landscape or calling it a series of landscape. You can certainly see the parallels there. So I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's roughly. And as I mentioned, that he's working in many modes simultaneously. So some of the works that we looked at when I was first talking were made around the same time as some of the ones that we see here. But when you get to the end of the exhibition tree there, that is the end of his career.
And what's his relationship with Mondrian? It looks like he's leaving behind diagonals as individuals. He's just staying with horizontal, maybe interpreting each other than complexity of all.
That's right. Certainly early on he was very much he admired Mondrian. He traveled to Amsterdam. He looked at a lot of his works there, and you certainly see it influence, and I certainly see it, especially in the first painting when you walk in the exhibition space. You certainly can see this this sort of homage to Mondrian, but I think as time goes on, he's going in his own directions as well. His career was short. He died tragically at the age of 33. And so whereas some of his close friends at the time, Sigmar Polka, Gerhard Richter, they became much more well-known because they outlived him by decades. Whereas he died very young. So in this exhibition, you're not seeing a full arc of a career, a beginning, a middle, and then an end. You're seeing a very creative career cut short, perhaps mid-career. I don't know. Yeah.
Given that these textiles were just off-the-shelf consumer products, they weren't necessarily meant to last for 40 years. In fact, the way that these pictures
Yes, I'm glad you brought that. Was something I was meant to say, is that as a textile historian, I know textiles don't last, and certainly these were mass-produced. They're okay textiles. They're not fine textiles. They were never meant to last more than a decade or so. People would use them for interior decoration. 10 years or so later, take them down and redecorate. So dyes certainly fade over time. Any dyes are going to fade over time. So the colors that you're looking at here, I would be very surprised if these were actually the colors they were when he produced these in the 1960s. It depends on how much exposure they've had to light. If they've been completely in the dark, they might not have faded as much. But we do need to keep in mind that, yes, these colors are probably more muted, actually, than what he than what they originally would have been. Yeah, but I'm surprised that they're in such good condition, and I think that is probably because many of them went into museum collections early and are being very well taken care of. DIN, Deutsche Industry Norm. And they sort of set the standard, like a textile must be, you know, this certain width for manufactured products, the dimensions. Yeah. And of course, he could make ones that are smaller than that, but the width would determine the maximum size that he could ever achieve with this type of painting.
So how is the fabric arranged on the picture plane relative to how it would have been on the vaulted fabric? Can you tell that?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, too. You know, in talking about the disposition of the textiles, whether they're vertical, like you see there, or horizontal, when these would have been sold in department stores, they would have been rolled out vertically, because you roll it out and measure it as it goes along. You don't do that horizontally. You roll it out so that it's always right directly in front of you, and you do that horizontally. So this horizontal orientation of these, it's also mimicking the way that you would have looked at them in a department store as well. They would have been laid out in front of you horizontally, not vertically. So while there is perhaps that landscape reference, there's also the possibility that this arrangement is also mimicking the commercial aspect, the fact that these are bought in a department store.
Great Barrel now has Miramico fabrics all on stretchers, and they're selling them as art for young professionals' apartments.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all, because, you know, I'm a textile historian. I do look at textiles as art. We should keep in mind that before the Industrial Revolution, textiles were among the most precious objects that people had. An enormous amount of time and labor goes into creating textiles. And so, you know, for centuries, so much artistic effort would go into creating these pieces. And we've lost track of that a bit, certainly in this age of mass-produced and machine-produced textiles. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all for coming on this rainy day.